This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. With the Oscars coming up next weekend, we're digging into how movie stars create their art. And to get there, we turn to the Cahiers du Cinéma, which at one time was the journal, not only for film criticism, but for inciting a wholesale reevaluation of how films got made. Founded in Paris in 1951, the Notebooks of Film, as translated into English, championed the French New Wave and poo-pooed the American Technicolor movies of the era, along with film noir and anything by Hitchcock. The international arts publishing house Fiden purchased the Cahiers du Cinéma a few years ago and has released a series on the craft called Anatomy of an Actor. Four of these coffee table-sized volumes have come out so far, focusing on what made the performances of Jack Nicholson, Meryl Streep, Al Pacino, and Marlon Brando so memorable. Philip Masiak is assistant professor of film studies at Louisiana State University. He writes the Dear Television column at the Los Angeles Review of Books, and he wrote about the Nicholson and Streep volumes of the Anatomy of an Actor series for Slate. Philip Masiak, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first, a little background on the series and the Cahiers du Cinéma. Fiden purchased Cahiers in 2009, already produced a series on great directors. What do you think they were aiming for with the focus on actors?
Well, I think that the director's art has been, over the past decades, an art that has been really thoroughly examined empirically. I think we know how directors create shots. We know a great deal because of periodicals like the Cahiers du Cinéma and interviews with directors. We know a great deal about how directors approach their craft, and we see them to some extent as craftsmen. We see them as people who are measuring things, lighting things, and sort of using the tools at their disposal to create a work of art. And I think that acting, to some extent, has not received as extended a treatment in that regard as directing has. You know, we talk about method acting as the sort of most famous way that we can think about actors, but even that process, which is a process, is shrouded in a kind of illusion. They replayed a great Philip Seymour Hoffman interview with Terry Gross last week, and he called it acting mumbo jumbo. And I think that that's really right about the way that the public perceives the actor's craft, that it is a kind of magical thing, right? You close your eyes, you put your hand over your face, and all of a sudden you create a part. Whereas I think there's a great deal more labor and intellect that goes into it that we don't explore quite so much.
Film acting is the last great mystery of the contemporary cinema, is how you put it in your article. But can this mystery be so easily described or even understood?
I mean, I think that's the great question, and that's one of the reasons why I think that aspect gets a little bit of a short shrift. It isn't as technical as the director's work, and so it's often more difficult, I think, for actors to describe what precisely they're doing. The book that I focus on primarily in the article, this about Meryl Streep by the wonderful critic Carina Longworth, that's one of the reasons this book succeeds, is because Meryl Streep is so sort of phenomenally articulate about all of the thought that she puts into the roles that she creates, both at the level of, you know, scene work. So, you know, what am I thinking about when I'm doing the scene? How am I creating this accent? But also at the level of where the role fits into a larger cultural narrative. Mm-hmm. Meryl Streep is extraordinarily articulate and extraordinarily smart about the way that she approaches her roles as sort of political acts.
Well, let's dig into this then. The series,
sure,
of Anatomy of an Actor, it's contemporary critics concentrating on 10 performances each. We mentioned Jack Nicholson, Al Pacino, Marlon Brando, and Meryl Streep. So let's look at Meryl Streep. Big breakthrough role as Linda in Michael Cimino's 1978 film, The Deer Hunter, followed shortly by Oscars for Kramer versus Kramer, and shortly after that, Sophie's Choice. Now, here is a scene that you write about, the courtroom scene from Kramer versus Kramer. Let's roll this. This is Meryl Streep as Joanna Kramer. She's on the stand making the case why she should have custody of her son.
I'm not saying he doesn't need his father, but I really believe he needs me more. I was his mommy for 5.5 years, and Ted took over that role for 18 months. I don't know how anybody can possibly believe that I have less of a stake in mothering that little boy than Mr. Kramer does.
Meryl Streep, their eyes convincingly welling up with tears. Walk us through that clip in the larger courtroom scene. What is Streep drawing on there?
Well, I think that one of the narratives that's most compelling that Longworth draws in her book about this and in her close attention to the scene is that Meryl Streep, in her early career, as many many actresses were during this period, faced with a lot of roles that were underwritten. And one of the things that Meryl Streep really appeared to put a lot of energy into doing was exercising the sort of small amount of power that her talent had given her to try to shape these roles into more well-rounded roles, to roles that spoke more of women's experiences. And this scene in particular is a really great example of that, because she entered into this film, Kramer versus Kramer, which as a popular novel beforehand had a kind of reputation as a novel about sort of female villainy to some extent, about how this woman could leave her family. And she felt very, very committed to the idea that this was a character whose choices were understandable, whose choices were worth thinking about. And she was actually given in this scene the opportunity to write her own dialogue. And I think that's why it makes a particularly good example of what Meryl Streep has been so good at, is simply making roles her own, in this case, literally.
Philip, her quick rise to fame has sparked a couple of backlashes through the years. There was a time when she was accused of getting paid too much. You know, it said she couldn't open a film. She was too serious. And then when she made a comedy, she was not a comedian. But reading the comments of your review, the biggest issue people seem to have with Meryl Streep is her accents. What's going on here?
I feel like this is to some extent the side problem that results from us not really talking that much about acting craft. The one thing that anybody can zero into when talking about how an actor produces a work is whether or not they're doing an accent. And I think for Meryl Streep especially, because she's done such a wide array of different types of accents and become sort of famous for it, that becomes very easily a thing that people who either are objecting to the work that she does or don't particularly care for her as an actress, to zero in on that particular element of any performance and say, oh, she's just doing that accent again. It's as you said, difficult to describe why a particular performance is great, but there are a lot of resources at hand for people in comment sections to talk about why a performance is bad.
Philip Masiak is with us. He teaches film studies at LSU, and he also wrote a review about Fiden's Anatomy of an Actor series. He wrote about it for Slate. We're kind of looking at that performance with the Academy Awards just coming up. Let's talk about the man that Streep is rumored to have had an affair with during their filming of Ironweed, Jack Nicholson. This book by Beverly Walker. What makes Jack Nicholson worth studying? He doesn't seem to have had the same sort of academic approach to acting as Meryl Streep did, certainly.
There was a particular comment in the comment section that I thought was a particularly interesting way of thinking about the difference between the two characters. Somebody said the difference between Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson is that Meryl Streep is an actor and Jack Nicholson is a movie star. And I think that one of the things that becomes interesting about Jack Nicholson is that after a certain point, his phenomenal run of great roles in the 70s, the reputation he had for those roles began to be matched by his public persona. And I think it produces both something interesting and also a challenge in writing about actors who are also extraordinary celebrities, because it bifurcates the subject. You have two things that you can write about.
He's one of that small club of actors who has won 3 Oscars, one in the 70s, one in the 80s, and one in the 90s, interestingly enough. Here he is in one of the strongest performances, to my mind, that great run in the 70s with the Chinatown, you know, 5 Easy Pieces, The Last Detail, and this one. He is playing Randall McMurphy in the film adaptation of Ken Kesey's novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest from 1975.
Do you think it might be possible to turn that music down so maybe a couple of the boys could talk?
That music is for everyone, Mr. McMurphy.
Yeah, I know, but you think we might ease it down a little bit so maybe the boys didn't have to shout? Huh?
What you probably don't realize is that we have a lot of old men on this ward who couldn't hear the music if we turned it lower. That music is all they have. Your hand is staining my window.
Sorry, ma'am.
All right.
Sorry.
Mr. McMurphy.
Huh?
Your medication.
Oh, the withering Nurse Ratched, played by Louise Fletcher there at the end. But this is the thing that people say, that Jack Nicholson doesn't act anymore. He's just Jack Nicholson playing Jack Nicholson. So is this it, Philip? Is the true test of an actor forgetting who they are in a role?
I'm not sure if that's the true test, but it's certainly something that, plays into it. And I think it's one of the things that people, I mean, as much as I say in the article that we need to move away from the model of thinking about acting as magic, and thinking about it instead as work or as a craft or as something with a distinct process. I mean, I think that's not to deny the fact that there is something sort of magical about acting, and part of that is the idea of forgetting that that someone is playing a particular role. And I think Jack Nicholson has certainly played a fair number of roles that could easily have been characters based on Jack Nicholson. You see something even later in life in a film like Something's Gotta Give with this sort of aging Lothario. But then you look at something like About Schmidt, where he plays in Alexander Payne's great film, he plays a sort of, you know, diminished version of himself. And in that film, I find it pretty easy to forget that that's Jack Nicholson.
Well, Philip, you did not review the books on the other two great actors in this series, Al Pacino and Marlon Brando. But I am curious to know about the field of actors that is out there now. Where are they picking up from the greats, and where are they departing?
Well, I think that one of the things that you see, you know, we don't talk about Christian Bale necessarily as a method actor, but we certainly see the kind of
extreme weight loss and gain.
the extreme weight loss and gain, the hair pieces, his American accent, which sounds suspiciously like Robert De Niro's American accent, really sort of put him, I think, almost self-consciously in the lineage of those sort of actors of the new Hollywood. I think it's really interesting to see someone like Matthew McConaughey, especially thinking, as we just were, about the career of Jack Nicholson. One of the really interesting things that that Walker really draws out in her book is about how formative Nicholson's early years in the Roger Corman company were. He was acting in these sort of pulpy movies and in many cases writing them, and really sort of working on his craft in movies that were not great movies. And Bruce Dern, the same thing is true of Bruce Dern. And I think that Matthew McConaughey was not certainly in sort of pulpy films, but he did this long stretch in the popular romantic comedy where, you know, he was, I think, often accused of, you know, just showing up for a paycheck and not really being that interested. And one of the narratives that's emerged over the past couple of years during what various critics have called the McConaissance is the idea that he's beginning to be interested in his work again. And he said things to that effect in interviews as well. And I think that what's really fascinating to watch here is an actor who had essentially been acting on autopilot for a little while. And we're seeing what he's capable of doing when he really locks in, when he really starts thinking about roles and the kind of diversity of roles that he's been able to play on, certainly in Dallas Buyers Club, but also in True Detective, which I would suggest is one of the best performances that he's done, to really, again, show this kind of control and show the choices that he's making as an actor.
And you would know, you're right down there in Southeast Louisiana, Southwest
Louisiana.
Where all
television programs are set.
Philip Maciak, he's assistant professor of film studies at LSU. He's also author of the Dear Television column at the Los Angeles Review of Books. He also reviewed the Anatomy of an Actor series for Slate magazine. You can find a link to more at wordofmouthradio.org.
From the dusty mesa, a looming shadow.
There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.